My name's Lou and I'm an addict. And this is the Utah NA history. Brittany asked me to do this. Earlier this year, we started an ad hoc history committee at the Utah region at my prompting. And I kind of got the inspiration from some podcasts that I've been listening to. There's a Living Clean podcast that is awesome, and they talk to a lot of people. I've watched the couple of the YouTube videos on the history of the basic text. There's another, I can't remember the name of it, Ron H. had a podcast that was, it's a little bit old, it's back in 2017, I think, but there's some awesome things about the beginnings of Narcotics Anonymous worldwide. So earlier, I think right about the first of last year of 2025, one of the old time members in our fellowship passed away, and it kind of sparked the idea of, you know, we need to write this stuff down, or we need to record this stuff, or we need to pick up this history, because I walked into Narcotics Anonymous in 1985. I know I don't look that old, but and my clean date is February 17th, 1986. I've there were three meetings when I got clean in NA: Friday night, Sunday night, and there was a Wednesday night candlelight. and then there started to be a few more. But anyway, this kind of set this in motion. I've really kind of been lax on it this summer, as usual. I bite off more than I can chew. I over allocate my time. And I've got a lot of changes happening in my life right now. So anyway, this is the inaugural interview, and the whole idea behind this is to interview some of the members that were here from the beginning. And Larry has been here as long as I've been here, right? Like April, May of 1986. And he's been a solid member of the Uwana area since day one. Thanks again for agreeing to be interviewed for Utah History Region. It's our hope to preserve the memories of longtime members for future members to understand the history of the Utah region and its areas, the who, what, how, and whys of our local fellowship. The Wasatch area is the oldest continuous area in the Utah region. With the help of NA communities in Ogden, Northern Area, Utah County, Central Area, and groups in Southeast Idaho, the region was formed in, I believe, 1988-89 time period. So with that, I'm going to get to it, and I'm gonna ask Larry to introduce himself, let us know what his clean date is and his current home group.
Oh God, save my ass if not my face. I'm Larry and I'm an addict.
Larry.
A grateful member of Narcotics Anonymous. My clean date is May 20th, 1986. And I've had continuous clean time and continuous involvement with Narcotics Anonymous since that time. It's changed over time, my ability and all that. But I was privileged to be around at a time that was special in the history of Narcotics Anonymous in Utah and Southern Idaho and Wyoming, and so it was a magic time, and I'm sure glad I got to do it.
Nice. So how were you first introduced to Narcotics Anonymous? Tell us that story.
Okay. I never went to any treatment centers. There weren't that many. Well, I don't know if there were any around when I got clean, but I never, I detoxed in a basement, and I still was wandering around, abstinent, but not clean, and crazier than a drunk Babylonian, heavily armed, and just was insane. And I went to a park that I lived by then, one of the big parks here, one night, and I ran into a guy that I'd known on the street, and I knew he was clean, or I'd heard he was clean. And I said, "How did you do it?" And he said, "I got something that works for me. It probably won't for you, but if you want to give it a try," and he gave me the time and the address of the regular Friday night meeting of Narcotics Anonymous. And that's how I was introduced to the program. Let me tell you about that first meeting.
Tell us about that first meeting.
I went down to the first meeting. It was at another fellowship hall. It was in a different place. And I walked in, and still heavily armed, looked around the room. And my first number one thought was, I've got abscesses older than most of these people, you know, and you were the wrong gender, the wrong race, the wrong, you know, religion, whatever it was. And that was my disease trying to kill me, trying to send me back out the door. But I didn't have anywhere to go. And an old timer came over and said, "Why don't you sit down and listen? These people have something to tell you that you might be able to use." And that's what I did, you know, and it was amazing. After that first meeting broke up, I walked over to, of course, I was younger then, the young lady, and I said, "You know, I use drugs longer than you've been alive, you know. How'd you get clean so young?" And she gave me this gift. She looked at me and said, "I got clean because I was dying. I don't know why you got clean." And there it was. I got clean because I was dying. And I get little gifts like that a whole bunch throughout my time. Okay.
So, it was the person that you met in the park, is he still involved in 12 steps?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, I saw him just a couple of weeks ago. And we laughed and talked and said, we should get together, but we probably won't.
Nice. So you began attending in May of 1986, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right. You already kind of went through that. So when you got clean, do you remember how many meetings there were at that point? There were the three.
I don't know about the candlelight. I think it was a little later. There was the regular Friday night, the unconditional love, and there was one that was out on like 39th South by that treatment center out there.
That was unconditional love.
Was it?
Was in the treatment center.
Okay, I never went out there. That was the suburbs, and I was a downtown dope addict, so I wasn't going out that far.
That was my first meeting, so I remember that one pretty distinctly. Tell me about what was your experience with sponsorship to begin with in the program or in 12 steps?
Yes, I got a sponsor, and actually he kind of got me, you know. I think he was seeing a charity. Oh, this sucker needs something. And we started talking. And what we did was we went down and, first of all, we went through a book that's from another fellowship. Our literature was not as robust as it is today. And we sat in, you know, he was an Irishman from New York City. My sponsor today is an Irishman from New York City. I don't know what I got about that kind of shit. But we sat down and we read that book, and then we read the white book, and I can't remember the first edition of the basic text we looked at, but I'm pretty sure it was a fifth. You know, I'm kind of a historical literature guy, but back then that was, you know, that was what we had. Mm-hmm. And we sat and read them. We didn't have step working guides. I got to tell you the truth, and this is just me. I don't want to say anything to anybody else about what they do. If you're clean today, I'm happy for you. But if I tried to work out of our new step working guide, I'd have blown my brains out, you know? And there were some around, the old school and the hardcore step working guides, but they were more guides than they were, you know, like this. And it just kept flowing. And I kept talking recovery everywhere I was, you know?
So the focus of this interview is going to be is mainly early service in Utah NA. So we like to ask about your involvement in service, what you recollect of it, and please name names, because we want to try and get everyone we can to share to get this to share their history of the early early Utah NA. So what was your first home group, and did you do service in it?
Regular Friday night meeting of Narcotics Anonymous. The first service I did in it was ashtrays. We could smoke in meetings back then. And the guy that sponsored me, that grabbed me, he came over and he handed me a damp rag. And he said, wipe it out after you dump the ashes out. It shows respect for the people that are coming after you. And that really, you know, that helped me. And that's what I did. And then I became the chair. Actually, I went to our area last month, and it's the first time I've ever been a GSR. You know, I successfully dodged that one. But I went through it, and that was basically the positions we had: treasurer, chair, we sort of had a GSR, but we really weren't formed. We weren't solidified as an area, and the region wasn't round. So.
Yeah, I that just brought up a memory of the clean time certificates they used to hand out at the Friday night meeting. That's where you went to get your cake, and we had these hand printed, probably on the mimeograph machine in those days. And then you put your number of years that you had, and you'd pass it around the meeting, and everybody would sign it.
Yeah.
I have a couple of those still kicking around from the Friday night meeting when I got 2 or 3 years clean. So probably your name is on one of them, I would imagine, if you were chairing. So, yeah, that's a good memory. What about meetings? One of the things that I remember in our area was meetings after the meeting, and doing stuff with people in the program. I mean, I know you have a couple words about that, and how close the fellowship was at the time.
I was not a big groups person, but I went out afterwards because I was told it would help me. And we went to that Chinese restaurant and went upstairs. And they finally threw us out of there, didn't they? Yeah, we got too noisy and too rowdy and too obscene. And, it helped me feel part of, you know. I'm still a loner, as you guys that know me well know. And it's hard for me to be in a group. But this saved my life. And this group helped save my life. And I got input from people that I didn't have before. You know, it would just be a joke or something, but I'd go, no shit, you know? I probably got a dent in my forehead from slapping it so much. And we went out, I don't remember going for coffee except in small groups. And then after the Barney's meeting, we started going for coffee. Barney's has a place in my history.
Good, nice, thank you. Why don't you tell us a little bit about Barney's meeting? I know that you were integral in probably starting Barney's Newfound Realities, a couple other meetings like that. I know in the early days you were involved in a lot of that.
We had an explosion of excitement in our fellowship. People started to come in because we were doing public information work. We were trying at that time. And Addy called me and said, 9:30 on Saturday night is prime getting high and partying time. We need a meeting. And so we tried it, and we did it at Fellowship Hall, but they kept putting dances over us or other fellowship speakers. You know, it wasn't real. And then we had to we tried to do it in someone's house. My suggestion is never do a meeting in a private home. Unless there's only four of you and you're in a sponsorship circle or something. But but we tried it at a home. And also, if you got a fireplace, don't start a fire if you got a room full of dope addicts. They'll burn your house down. I was looking for a place, and I was at my work. I had a job. Now, there was something new. And I was at my work on my break, and I was calling places. And my boss walked behind me. And she said, you know, I'm on the board of directors for the church. Mount Tabor? No.
Uh,
All Saints Episcopal.
Yeah.
And she said, if you'd like to do a meeting there, we already have some of a couple of other fellowships, and I'll bring it up. And it was just a chance she passed behind me while I was calling places. And that meeting's still there. And it became a very large meeting. It's kind of shrunk, as a lot of our meetings have recently. And then the Barney's meeting started with somebody chewing out the person that was heading up the Newfound Realities, and because she spent too much money on good coffee. So she grabbed the coffee pot and said, come on, you know, and she grabbed the coffee. I had to carry the coffee pot. We're gonna start another meeting, and we went down and found Barney's location and started it there. So Barney's meeting started with a coffee pot and an argument about what kind of coffee to buy. Principal discussion. And it's been there ever since.
Yes, it has. So when do you remember being part of the Area Service Committee?
Yeah. I was printing the schedules. That was something I did for the Area Service Committee.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I worked at a place where they had the copy machine, and they said if I brought my own paper, that was fine. And so I would go to it. And my first commitment was to the Public Information Subcommittee. And I'm going to talk a bit about the Public Information Subcommittee a little later, maybe. It's now Public Relations doing public information. If the public can't find us, they don't know where to come. And that was the basic rule.
And that was your first area type of commitment?
Yeah.
Did you do any other jobs at Area at that point, or in the
No, I was
areas?
Area chair, and I was vice okay. chair, and regional alternate something, you know. I did all of those things because I was so excited to be clean. I used a long time, and I never thought I'd get clean. And I was so excited, so I took those as they came open and then tried to pass them off to someone else. And I did a lot of them multiple times. I was area chair three or four times, which meant I was vice chair. They suckered me. They said, will you be vice chair? And I said, yeah. And they said, okay. And after I was accepted and all that, they said, oh, by the way, it's a 2-year commitment. You have to be chair for next year. I said, oh. Heard that railroad train ringing, yeah. But it worked out for me great.
What do you remember? Where literature back then? Where we got it? What we had? I know we were, you know, basically all we had was a white book, some pamphlets, and the basic text was at that point 3-4 years old.
Yeah.
So.
You know, I don't know where we got it because the region wasn't around yet, but we had a member of our fellowship, and he's still around. I don't feel comfortable really sharing his name, but he would get it mm-hmm. because he was on some rural boards. You know, mm-hmm. Yeah, and he would get it, and I don't know where it came from. It came up on the table, give it out, you know, and as soon as we found out. And I called World Service. When I was area chair, I called World Service. You know, I know they answered the phone, and I'd say, hi, this is Larry. I'm the area chair in Salt Lake City, and I got some questions. And they'd hold the phone over their chest, and they said, okay, it's that idiot from Salt Lake. Whose turn is it to take this call? And you got to talk to real people, you know? And they started all their conversations by saying, we don't set policy. We collect experiences. And they would share those with me. So, you know, I was in contact with them regularly. And they were still, you know, funding literature out of their pockets. And, you know, so it was an exciting time, and it was a worthwhile time.
So, if I remember correctly, we started forming the region in late 88, early 1989. I remember this because my sponsor made me go. And I remember going up to the Rock Church in Ogden, and several other places, and getting more involved with other, because by then we had meeting, there were meetings down in Provo, and there were meetings in Ogden. And so can you, what's your recollection of that, of forming the region and getting that stuff going?
Yeah, I thought about it. I don't have a real recollection of forming the region, but I knew it happened at that time. And I knew that it kind of solidified us, but I wasn't sure what their role was, what they did, you know. And in our service structure, the region supports the areas, and the areas support the groups, and the groups support the members. That's our service structure, you know. And so I went to region, and I had held some positions there, excuse me, public information. Basically, that was my, what I dealt with the most. And it was insane. And I remember going out with somebody that's in this room, and his sponsor, and me and my sponsor. For, you know, we would sit up there and argue and bump bellies and yell and, you know, spit out our mouth because we were arguing about things that were important for life. And then we go out afterwards and talk about spiritual principles. It was a real special time for me.
Yeah, I had no idea what the difference was myself at that point in my recovery, what region was, what area was, what world was. I mean, it was just stuff to do, and it kept this addict out of the bar by going to service meetings, right? Like, that was kind of the deal in those days. I'm amazed we did anything, quite frankly, but... But argue and we're good at that. Yeah, we're pretty good at that, and start new meetings because we got mad at the last one. We still kind of do that. But talk to me about your PI, some of your PI work back then.
Yeah.
Because I know you're integral in getting a lot of that stuff going.
Well, public information for me was the way to go. And I'd copped an attitude towards H&I, you know, and so I went that way, and there was a man, his name was James, some people know him as Squid, who was also instrumental at that time. And the Utah, the Uwana area, formed the first public information committee, and the region formed it. And then we joined the Western States Regional, you know, we sponsored the Western States Regional Public Information Gathering here in Salt Lake City a couple of times. And we would bring people from Hawaii to Colorado. California had their own, Washington, Oregon, Idaho, us, Colorado, White, you know, that group. And they all came and we shared what worked. And that was the basic purpose of it, not to set policy, not to do anything. What are you doing that works? You know, what is the most important personal literature? And it's still, in my opinion, the schedule. We started doing it. We sponsored it a number of times. I helped. I don't know how to say this because I'm not a real structure person. I was very involved in it, and I disagreed, because that's who I am, we got through it, and we had a very, very strong public information focus at that time, and it really grew. It grew here. We took over hotels to sponsor people coming all the way from Hawaii and all of those to talk about what they did that worked, and we tried to keep it at a real simple level. At that time, we had a public information committee, and it was very, very active. We took out our literature racks with the IPs on it and put them in different places, and then went around and restocked them, because so the places where addicts would come. And, you know, and so it seemed to work. People started to come to our meetings, and the meetings exploded, and people started starting meetings. And people started. It was a very, very special time in my life.
I do remember that period early. I think by this time we were probably in the early 90s.
Yeah.
And the meetings, we exploded. Do you remember when the Wasatch area split up mm-hmm. into two areas?
Yeah, one south, yeah, 33rd one south, yeah. and one north of 33rd
yeah,
south.
Do you got any recollection of that? Anything?
I didn't go south of 33rd south. Yeah. Right, you know, you'd have to have a passport to go that far south. But I do remember it, and I remembered structurally, excuse me, it created some divisions in our larger group, and I think then we put it back together, and it seemed to work pretty well, but we're still a spread out area, and I still don't drive down.
Yeah, I seem to remember a lot of controversy around that. I myself was, I think that's when our first baby was born, and so this addict was trying to be a something.
How'd that work for you?
How'd that work? Boy, got me doing a lot of step work eventually. Kids are fun. Okay, so what about Campvention? Do you remember, because Campvention, originally Campvention was a Wasatch area campout. The first two or three were a campout, and for all I know, we could have just done them in Liberty Park rather than one in the mountains. But do you have any anything with that?
By that time, you know, I was, I met my wife in the rooms, and we'd gotten together and had our daughter. And I decided I was going to this Campvention that we were doing, and it was up in Huntsville, where we do now. Mm-hmm. And so I rode my bicycle, and my wife followed with all the camping stuff in the car. And we got up there, and I couldn't find you. And I can't remember who I called. It might have been you. And I said, "Where are you guys? We can't find you." And they said, "It's next week." And that's the story of my life. It's next week. But coming back downhill was a lot more fun than going up. Then I spoke at one. And we thought we were technology geniuses. We had one of those little office cassette, and then come up and do it. And then they'd say pause, and I spoke at that one. And I still have that tape. I tried to find it last night. Before I ever do an engagement, I try to listen to it. Basically to make sure my story hasn't grown. It's certainly changed, but it hasn't, and grown in recovery, but I wasn't, all of that out when I was out there. But and then a couple of years later, I spoke, a few years down the road, they'd asked me to speak as a local speaker. By then we were bringing in national speakers. And I was sitting up around a campfire with a friend of mine. It was headbanger music era, and so we were all up there and swapping lies and talking shit about everybody. And we were sitting there, and this guy came up and he said, "I'm camped right down there. It's not my kind of music. Can I sit here with you guys?" And we sat there and slapped hands and swapped lies and just did all of it through the night. And the next night I spoke, and then they introduced Bob B., the only guy with his story in the basic text twice. And he was the national speaker. He never once had to say, "I'm a bigwig." Mm. He was just one of us. And it taught me about humility. There is no addict that's more or less or anything else than another addict. And I talked to him a few times after that. He was a good man. He was one of the first literature chairs. He had a Cadillac, and he said it was all in the trunk of the Cadillac. And I'd say, instead of slinging dope on Hollywood and Vine, I'd be on Hollywood and Vine at noon throwing out literature to all the groups that came by. And so I got to meet some of our real predecessors.
Thank you. So who do you remember from those days that I should add to this list of people that I need to interview that might not be coming around as much, but besides the list of usual suspects we talked about?
Mike C.
Mike C.
He's up in Seattle, but he'll do it over Zoom.
I will do do that. Anyone else?
I will send them to you. There are some that I know.
If you come across it, the other thing is, do you have, what about archives? Do you have archives, any paper type stuff from that period, the 80s into the early 90s in your stuff? That's one of the things that
I probably have it stored away somewhere, but I can't remember what I had for breakfast, so I probably won't be able to remember. But I have a partner that can definitely say, over there, and get it out of that room. I'm tired of looking at it. I'll look and see.
If you would be so kind as to go take a look, and I will make copies of it and bring it back to you. One of the things that we're doing is we have an archive on the Utah Region website that we're putting PDFs of a lot of our documents and schedules and stuff that one thing that I forgot to ask you about was, do you remember the newsletter that we used to have in our area? I love that, and we have a few copies of that.
I don't know
whatever happened, why we quit doing it, but we don't do it. You know, we quit doing it at some point.
It's probably an argument over coffee.
And which was a cool thing. Some of those are on there. We had some stories that we probably took out of the NA Way, and then some of our own members would contribute stories and stuff, and we'd publish a monthly newsletter in the Uwana area. So get a chance, go to the region website and take a look at it. I would think it'd be pretty cool if somebody would start that up again, but I'm not going to. if you could pick, like, what memories, what things would you preserve or put in the forefront of what we used to do and what we might not be doing right now?
Okay. I don't know how to start. You know, the fellowship has changed, and that's okay. And doesn't mean I like it. It just means I accept it, you know, and things I cannot change.
What would you bring back, or what would you do? What do you have memories of that you think we need to be doing today that we don't necessarily do? Memories to preserve.
Yeah. I think at our base level, the area, we need to get committees back to work. Not the H&I chair who's trying to find speakers, but actual, you know, meetings besides area. And certainly true with public information. You know, it's too big a job for the one person we have to do it. And they all do a good job. They all do a good job, but we can't ask them to do that much. They can't carry us. And we need to, whatever your area, wherever you're from, get involved in that kind of service. And like I said, I actually went to an area meeting. It's been a long time. Like first time I'd ever been a GSR, I won't do that again. I think we need to build the enthusiasm, because we have ideas and people with history and people who want to do stuff but don't know how. You know, we need to approach all of them. And this is just me again. We need to quit relying on the drug courts and treatment centers to bring us people. We need to reach out to those people and bring the people and leave the stuff outside. You know, and I was instrumental in the drug court thing. You know, I did it once. It seemed like a good idea. In retrospect, it stopped us from really doing our public information and our, you know, H&I kind of robust kind of things. Because there's addicts out there dying today. You know, I live on the west side, right? You know, beside the river there, and they're slinging fentanyl within a block of my house, and we got the, you know, ambulances down there regular. I feel right at home, but other people are moving out. We're faced with a great crisis in the drug-using community, and we've limited ourselves in resources to bring those people in, you know. And I think that H&I, the one H&I commitment that I loved and I would still be doing if they hadn't have moved the prison, I went out to the prison. And, you know, it was really cool. I went out there for years, so every Sunday night, and the man that I sponsored, we'd meet and talk, you know, steps. Then we'd go out to the prison. And some of those people are out now. You know, I have one of them that's up in Wyoming. He's off parole for the first time since he was 18. He was doing life on the installment plan, we used to call it, you know, when I was on the street. And we recently lost one who could not stay clean, but he couldn't go back to prison, so he, you know, he ended it. And I felt real bad. But the really cool part of it, at the end of the night, you walked out and the gate closed behind you, and you went, yeah, I'm out of here. But I, you know, I think we need to stretch our boundaries. You know, I know the women's prison, we're having trouble with that too. You know, we need to look at what we can do different as a group.
Thanks, Larry. So, well, I know we call it H&I, PRPI, but all that stuff is the 12 step.
Yeah.
And that, I think we...
Oh, that's the other one I just wanted to say.
Go ahead.
The most important thing you can do, remember, I had that addict that approached me in a park, and I've been clean since then. When that newcomer comes in and sits down, looking scruffy, just off the street, go over and introduce yourself. You know, invite him out afterwards. If you're broke and I'm there, just talk to me. I'll give you some money, take him to coffee. You know, I have to get home. I turn into a pumpkin pretty early now. But I, you know, that therapeutic value of one addict helping another addict, and that does it. And I had a real interesting experience recently. I went to a meeting I hadn't been to in a long time, and someone came over and sat down beside me and asked me if I was new to NA. And the guy on the other side said, oh, no. And the guy got embarrassed and left, and I chased him down. And I said, you did exactly the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody comes in that you don't know, go over and introduce yourself. You know? And if you're full of shit like I am, somebody else will tell them that.
You know, I think that's all I've got right now, Larry. I'd really like to thank you for speaking. I'm going to let people ask questions, but I want to give applause to Larry.
Yeah.
So if anybody wants to ask a question, anyone? Todd.
More than a question, I want to say thanks for what you're doing to get this stuff recorded, archived, and all that kind of thing. When I first heard of this, it was, of course, in a region meeting, but when my mom suddenly dropped dead one day, I was like, how the fuck am I going to know all this stuff? Because she's the only one that knew. And that's kind of where we're at. So thanks to Lou, I've been listening to that podcast you referenced, and I listen every time I come to Salt Lake and go to prison and stuff like that. And, but listening to that and understanding what those guys went through, so a lot of those people are passed. You know, Jimmy Kay and a lot of those guys are gone. There are a few people that are still around. I'm still active members of NA, but there's only a few. And it's to get it from their words and to hear it firsthand, what we have today through the controversies they went through is amazing. You guys get an opportunity to hear the hard history of Narcotics Anonymous. Search for it, find it. The Living Clean podcast has some on there, but there's more. It's on YouTube and other places, like Lou said. But it's intense to think of what those folks went through in the creating basic text and stuff like that. You know, the guy that rode his tricycle from Nebraska to Florida just to be on the literature panel.
Yeah. Selling blood to get to
them. Selling blood. I mean, the basic text was on, well, we'll hear about that. But anyway, thanks guys for doing that. Thanks for sticking around. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, thanks for taking the time of your lives to ad hoc a committee like this and to put it together. I appreciate all that.
And I will, I just want to second it, you know. My current sponsor, you know, he helped start NA in New York City, but he moved out to be close to Jimmy. And he told me, he said, the worst thing we can do is make Jimmy into a martyr, into a saint. He was one of us. He would storm around the kitchen and cuss and throw stuff down. And he said, and because I couldn't have related to somebody who was some California, you know, California recovery. Anyway, so I talked to him, and there are a few around that just know that history, you know. And Bo S. is still around, and he was instrumental in our basic text. I hear he's not seeing people too much right anymore, but yeah.
Blake, I was hoping you could expand maybe a little bit on specifically what a public relations person could do to get the people that you're referring to in treatment centers and stuff into the meetings, because that's similarly something that, you know, I see not happening. I don't see a lot of newcomers coming in, so
yeah
I was wondering what your experience of how do we get them here exactly.
Good question. Yeah, how do we get them here? Meeting dope addicts is easy. Go where dope addicts are. You know, I know that my home group at one time just printed up a one-page flyer that said, "Got a drug problem? We can help," and had the tear-offs with the phone number on it. You know, and some people went to area and said, "It's got to say maybe we can help." Mm-hmm. Screw that. We can help. You know, and you put those kinds of things out. We had the resources to put literature racks. I know we had one at the AIDS Foundation. We had one at somewhere down by the methadone clinic. You know, and we would restock those. Nothing in them but schedules and maybe five IPs, you know. And just keep going with that, you know. And public relations, I don't have relationships with government entities. But if I have to talk to them to get to the addicts, then that's what we got to do, you know. And in this world now, with a whole bunch of options, I am really blessed that those options weren't around when I got clean, because I'd have hustled them like a sumbitch. You know, I'd probably still be, you know, strung out on a drug replacement thing and working at, you know, all of those kinds of things. None of those things are bad. They just weren't what happened to me, and I'm glad that I didn't have that opportunity, because I wasn't. My sponsor, I talked to him twice a week, and he, at least once a week, he'll say, "You aren't the sharpest knife in the drawer, are you?" And he's right. You know, I still want to try. I'm gone back to area. I'm looking at starting to take a more active role at that. You know, I can't travel like I used to. God, I want to go back to Russia. The Russian Fellowship, if you ever get a chance to go, go. You know, I've been twice, and it just was amazing for me. And, you know, and in this technology age, and that's part of our problem, when the COVID hit and we started the Zoom meetings, I was bummed. But I'm going to tell you, Zoom meetings saved my life. You know, I sponsor men in Moscow and Thailand and talk like that once a week, because I just can't get out like I used to, you know. And but we need to use it as a tool, not as an end product, because seeing another addict and talking to them and putting that hug on them at the end is the core of our fellowship. And get excited, try stuff, and if it doesn't work, try something else, you know. If it doesn't work, pass it on to me, and I'll try it twice before I pass it on to someone else. You know, I still ain't the sharpest knife in the drawer. Other questions?
Amy Addict. Kind of going off that, what, I feel like whenever I have, like, ideas for, like, PI or anything like that, I get really stuck on, like, the attraction rather than the promotion. Like, what is that, like, line in your opinion? Do you know what I mean? Like, the flyers with the tear-offs and stuff, and then, like, obviously we're in an age of, like, social media, stuff like that, or talking to government officials, like you were saying. Like, what is that line in your opinion?
I'm not sure. I have an answer for what the fine line is.
Yeah.
But our start is to get them to a meeting where there are addicts, and then they can see the attraction.
Mm.
You know? And to do that, we have to do our public relations, public information, H&I. And I think we can go back to putting racks out there. You know, I don't think printed literature really can grab a brand newcomer, you know.
Yeah.
They'll probably use it to store their syringe in their back pocket.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know, and I don't care. I just hope they read at some point. And give your phone numbers out. You know, I give mine out, and actually, I'm a deaf old bugger. I took my hearing aids out just before I came in here. You know, losing his hearing, but he don't care what most people say. But I'll tell you this, my phone rings at 1 a.m., I answer it. You know, call me. Because my demons, and I don't think anybody's, my demons don't come out between 8 and 4:30 when the social workers, God save us from the social workers. I'm married to one, but, well, sort of. But I, calling another addict can save someone's life. And you know, people tell me all the time, oh, nobody stays clean because you do that, nobody does. Well, no, somebody does, me. You know, I can only keep what I have by giving it away. And try to give it away with love and acceptance. I don't have to agree, I just have to accept.
Well, I think that is all the time we have. It looks like people are moving in for the next one.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
One real quick one. When I was in Russia and they were translating our literature, there is no clear translation from Russian for the word trust. It translates as before faith. And that just said so much to me, you know, because I had to trust you people before I could have faith that this worked. And so be trustworthy. Do what you say you're going to do. Ain't too much to it. If you can't do it, don't say it. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Larry. Third step prayer.